Oh, yeah.
What's incredible about him is the man is extremely arrogant. Well, it's kind of in the corridors right next to Department 2, and sitting down around Department 3 is Sergeant Steve Clark, who was the man, the only witness, really, against you.
That's true.
And there was an expert witness, but he was the only percipient witness who claimed that you solicited, cocaine on the levee on October 4th for another man.
Right, he's the one that wants to brand me, the drug dealing, million dealing.
I think there's a real question whether Clark has been engaging in a series of busts to boost his reputation, harassing many innocent people in order to get a kind of a high quota. Do you have any other indication that that's the case?
When I came here for preliminaries on my case today, most of the defendants in court that day were victims of Mr.
Sergeant
Clark's little sting operation. And when we were outside smoking cigarettes, I asked three people that were there on them specific charges. It maybe was similar to my case where there was drunkenness involved, and two out of three were drunk, totally drunk, like a six-pack or more drunk. And so I just see it as Mr. Clark's way of accomplishing fighting his crime is through picking on drunks, is all I can see.
Do you have any specific experiences where you're aware that Sergeant Clark has had a particular focus on homeless people or people with alcohol problems?
No, just now.
Just now. And would you have heard of it? I mean, or should we assume that that has not been the case because you haven't heard of specific instances? Would you have been aware of it if it were the case? Or might you not be aware of it?
I'm not aware of Mr. Clark at all, except for my incident. And then now I've heard of, I've talked to people that were there on charges similar to mine because of him. And it all points at the same thing. He just hangs around near bars and just picks on drunks to sell them drugs. And then when somebody's drunk, they're willing to do
so
that.
Suggesting Clark is entrapping people at bars and places of that
sort?
You prepared to say that publicly, perhaps to take him into a law?
So he's doing it to me right now.
I think that would be helpful for the community to have Sergeant Clark have to answer in a public place for that kind of behavior.
I hope so.
And that was a replay of a conversation between myself and Jorge Castro, who indeed was a victim of Sergeant Clark's false accusations in a court case in which he was able to persuade the jury through his defense counsel, Ben Rice, and a series of strong character witnesses, plus not the least of which was his own clear, unshakable story himself. And those of you who follow my show have heard Jorge Castro speaking on the air about this case, so we don't want to belabor it a great deal. I'm just going to kind of cover a few peripheral points. Even though Jorge has won his case, there are, of course, dozens of other victims of Clark who have to go into court and suffer the same kinds of accusations of drug dealing on the levee. Some of them may indeed be guilty, and I've got to admit to a prejudice. I don't feel anybody should be arrested or convicted or jailed or punished for a consensual sale of a drug or a purchase of a drug, since drugs are such a huge part of the economy, and it's usually the poor people who are getting caught up in this drug prohibition war. So I have no hesitation in giving you my own prejudices and biases on this question. But aside from that, if we have a police department that is manufacturing charges, as seems to be the case here in the Jorge case, the Jorge Castro case, then I think we are in trouble. And if Sergeant Clark is one of the primary offenders, then he needs to be brought to book. He needs to be called on this issue. And I hope anyone listening will do so. And I'd like to point out that for the first time in about 6 months, maybe more, perhaps less, We have a phone call-in number for the Free Radio station. And the call-in number for those of you who want to call in to Free Radio Santa Cruz is 423-5361. And I'm just making sure the phone line is on. So if you feel free to give me a call, and we can talk about this case. I am going to be kind of delaying calls to get some of the recorded segments done. For instance, this next segment I'm going to play for you is a rather significant and interesting discussion with a juror in the Jorge Castro case, a juror who explains why he felt the prosecution had not proved its case, and indeed for some jurors that the main prosecution witness, Sergeant Steve Clark, was not in fact telling the truth, or at least certainly not the whole truth. But before we get to that, and I'm going to have to cue that up, I'm going to play you another bit of music, and then we'll get right into that. That's Rolling Home with Peter, Paul, and Mary. You're listening to Bathrob Spears Broadsides, 96.3 FM on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm your host, Bathrob Spear Robert Norse. And in the studio with me, silent but soon to speak, is Jorge Castro. We've been talking about his case. He was charged with a misdemeanor count of soliciting drugs on the levee from an incident that happened on October 4th of last year, principally on the testimony of Sergeant Steve Clark. Before I play you what a juror had to say about this, who we interviewed after the verdict when Jorge was unanimously found not guilty, I want to read you a little bit from an old street shit sheet. Now, those of you who are listening may not know what the street shit sheet is. It's a homeless newsletter that was published considerably more regularly back in the late 80s and early 90s than it is today, but it still occasionally comes out. I write most of it. Other individuals who are homeless or writing about homeless issues add to the street shit sheet, and essentially concerns itself with voices from the street and issues that affect folks on the street. And this was August 20th, 1988, street shit sheet number 21, and the story was, "The kicker draws his gun. Clark's capers, the talk of the mall." I'm going to read this story. Disquieting allegations have been pouring in regarding the conduct of our own beloved officer Clark. He was officer in those days and not sergeant until he was promoted for his good behavior. I won't even comment on that. After a report that Clark kicked and threatened the limping Jay Miller Thursday night before last, another man on crutches reported a similar incident early this week, arrested under the sleeping ban for an old warrant. This man reported Clark told him he'd be kicked in the injured leg if he didn't leave town. The same day, August 17th, a third man filed a formal complaint at the police station against Clark, alleging he violently abused a drunk in front of Shockley's, then a bar, and threatened the complainant, seeking to stop him from witnessing the situation. Finally, on the evening of August 18th, half a dozen witnesses allegedly saw Clark draw his gun on a man carrying a skateboard after the skateboarder had objected to Clark's demand that he shut up and offered to fight Clark fairly. "Down on your knees and say your prayers" was reportedly what the fastest gun on Pacific Avenue told the trembling skateboarder. We suggest a vacation for the hyper-enthusiastic policeman in some far-off jurisdiction where his sleep and ours may remain undisturbed. Now, this was 10 years ago. 10 years ago in the street shit sheet. But as you can see, if the police department does not rein in its rogue and renegade cops, they continue to flourish and do what they find easiest to do, harass homeless and poor people. And that apparently was what Sergeant Clark was doing on the night of October 4th at the levee, and what the jury, at least in part, may have believed as it came to its verdict. Let's listen to a juror and what he had to say about this situation as he spoke to us outside the corridor on Tuesday, outside the court on Tuesday afternoon.
We had reasonable doubt.
So in summarizing, and again, your name is?
Ken Robertson.
And in this hour verdict on the jury, the main reason you came to the decision that it was not because you found the police officer necessarily lied, but rather because you felt that he perhaps misunderstood what went on?
This could be. He could have lied, or he might have just misunderstood. There were two different accounts, but they were close enough to be their own views of what had happened. It could have been the same event. And it was one man's word against the other.
Did the expert witnesses, the character witnesses, make any difference in your or other people's assessment?
I believe the main thing that made a difference was the police officer's understanding of the Spanish language.
Really? And did that, was that point clear to you before the summation by defense attorney Ben Rice? Did you notice it during the course of the trial, or did it come out through that defense summation?
It came out during the officer's own testimony.
So you noticed that yourself as it was happening?
Oh, yes.
And his command of Spanish was perhaps, well, he admitted it was not a perfect one.
Yes, and while we all think that's a failing on the police department, it has no bearing on the case of whether Jorge were guilty or not. We think the police department should have people who know the language if they're going to be dealing with Spanish-speaking people.
Mm-hmm. So how is it that the issue of Spanish became the crucial point here? Can you clarify for us why that issue really did turn the trick?
The issue was basically what was said on the levee. All the events before and after were peripheral to the crime. The crime was whether he solicited. Whether he would or not really is conjecture, you know.
Whether it was in his character to do it or
yeah,
not. Did he or didn't he was the question.
Did he or didn't he? And the fact is, he said he had a long conversation in Spanish. The officers say they only heard three words. One was rock, one was coca, which he could have said when he was explaining and arguing, you know, what are you going to do, cook this coke here, and, you know. Mm-hmm. And if they had only picked out those words and they were scrambling to understand what he was saying quickly in Spanish, not speaking Spanish, mm-hmm. then they could have thought they had a valid bus that he was asking for it. But the officer said he only heard these words. There were other discrepancies in the testimony.
Such as?
The fact that Jorge says Kylie instigated the sale and was talking with the officers, and the officers say that Kylie was passive during the whole thing.
What did the jury come to a conclusion on that issue? Or?
They said it was just the difference between the two testimonies. You had to believe one person or the other.
And who did the jury believe?
The jury came to no conclusion on that.
And so there was reasonable doubt, or just simply
there
accept
was
the issue?
Reasonable doubt.
So in essence, it came to believe that the defendant, while perhaps not innocent, was certainly not. Did you feel the defendant, and the distinction that was made by the defense attorney Ben Rice about the Scottish system, guilty, innocent, not proven, which is their verdict,
had no bearing on any of our decision making?
But on that spectrum, was he just not guilty, or did you feel he was innocent? What was the jury's decision on that?
The jury refused to discuss amongst themselves whether they thought he was. They were after exactly what they were asking. Did we have a reasonable doubt?
And you found you did.
And we found that we had reasonable doubt.
Were there any holdouts for a while, or was it just pretty much a consensus discussion?
It was a consensus. Once we all discovered, you know, that our speaker for us kept trying to present more of the evidence, and finally it was discovered we all felt the same thing. We said, well, why prolong it? We have come to a decision. We all feel the same
way. Including the foreperson.
Including the foreperson.
You did ask at one point that a certain bit of evidence be read back. What was
yes,
that?
We did. That was the cross-examination of Jorge on what exactly was said on the levee. We wanted to know. He had stipulated in his testimony that he refused to say this had happened because of where people were standing, not that he did not say that.
I remember that, yeah.
And that was a sticking point with us. Well, did he or did he not say that? And we thought the defense, or the
And that was a juror discussing why the jury decided as it did in the Jorge Castro case last Tuesday, where Jorge was found not guilty of soliciting a cocaine deal, even though he was he's been dragged through the courts for 5 months on this issue and lost at least one job because of it by his testimony here on the radio station at our last show. And as you can see, the decisions that the jury came to were really largely technical, which in a way kind of dismays me, though perhaps we should be reassured because the jury sort of tried to be obedient to the judge's instruction. In this case, it was probably the best possible judge that Jorge could have. In our local courts, Commissioner Salazar is probably the most fair and sympathetic to poor people, the most willing to give them an opportunity to defend themselves. And of course, Jorge had the benefit of a very talented defense attorney, also a very high-priced defense attorney who took Jorge's case for free, Ben Rice, who has been helpful to homeless people in many cases, in many occasions in terms of just general action, for example, to set up a Citizens Police Review Board in the early 90s. He did a videotape called Fight Your Ticket in the late 80s. Quite a defense lawyer with a commitment to helping folks who don't have all the advantages. But again, the thing that kind of depresses me is that the jury didn't really go to the heart of the issue, other than simply, I guess perhaps for them the heart of the issue was reasonable doubt. They didn't have to decide that Sergeant Clark was lying. All they had to decide was that the prosecution hadn't proved its case. And maybe we belabored this case too much, and I apologize to the audience for kind of running through details that probably most of you aren't aware of or perhaps not even interested in. I'm interested in seeing justice done, the drug war ended, poor people not harassed by the police department on these kinds of charges, and bad cops called to account. But let's lay that issue aside for the moment, because we have in the studio, waiting patiently for the last hour, Jorge Castro, who wants to talk about a number of issues. Anything more you want to say about the trial before we leave that issue, Jorge?
Well, I'd like to say that I before my trial and everything, my charges were brought against me. I've never been harassed in any form or manner by any police officers in Santa Cruz. Never have they been a constant harassment, not to me, anyway.
And you've been around for quite a while.
Since 1980.
And would you say that would you extend this sense that the police are pretty fair and pretty non-harassing generally? Would you say you are a particularly low-profile person, or how would you make any broader characterization?
Well, presently I'm a low-profile person. That's my alcoholism stopped. So, but even before that, whenever I was approached by police, on many occasions, it was due to my own fault. So I can't call that harassment.
You were around in the early 80s when Code Blue was in effect, when police were actually intentionally beating up homeless people. You're familiar with that period?
Well, a lot of my friends went through them time periods.
And you were lucky enough to avoid getting the baton in that particular time period?
No, I've never been hurt by any police officer or struck or anything like that. They're pretty nice. I mean, believe it or not, I mean, these cops are a lot better than most cops throughout the nation. They're very fair-minded police officers.
You know, I tend to agree with you, although perhaps some would be surprised to hear me say so. I've not myself ever been physically abused by any Santa Cruz police officers, and I have been arrested dozens of times, almost without exception, on charges that had to do with political issues and the rights of poor people to be sleeping in public places and such. Last time we didn't talk about the San Lorenzo Lumberyard much, but you told me at the beginning of the show that you also wanted to discuss that issue in the context of a broader solution to what you consider the principal homeless problems in Santa Cruz?
Yes, that's my main concern. That's the reason I came to your show last week, and we got a little ways down the road on the issue, but we had surprise guests that day, so we never got to the issue, but I have to bring that issue up front, so maybe we can figure out how to end the problem.
Well, let's discuss it. As I recall, you were talking about how services offered currently for homeless people at the Homeless Community Resource Center proposed even the services that were available and are no longer available, like the Coral Street Open Air Shelter. Even those services were not really sufficiently appealing to hardcore homeless people who often are alcoholics, living in camps like around Lighthouse, Liquors, and out in Nuri Lagoon, possibly in the Poconip and out down the tracks. And you are trying to find some way to make services available. Let me ask you this. Are you trying to find a way to make services available to those people, or are you concerned that those people pose us in some way a danger to the community and should be themselves kind of, forcibly removed from those areas into services?
The point I'd like to make is that since the 80s, a lot of the community would like to see an end to the homeless problem. But as we provide more services because they dislike the services available, they just go deeper into the woods, so to say. And the deeper they get, the harder it is to get them out of there. And so the problem just keeps reoccurring, and the people demand more services for the homeless, and then they give more services to the homeless, yet the harassment of people for spare change and everything continues, because in order to end the problem, you have to go to the main core of the ones that have gotten lost into this, you know, this crack in the sidewalk. They're just going farther and farther down the crack.
By crack of the sidewalk, you mean that little juncture hole in the sidewalk, not the white substance that you were being charged with soliciting.
Right. So no matter how much money they pour into services for the homeless, they still have the same pocket of people spare changing downtown or at the liquor store areas or the Safeway areas or out on Mission Street or whatever. And no matter how much they give now to these services, this certain pockets of people aren't taking advantage of the services, so they're still spare changing and doing all the things that the community seem to think that by providing services will end this problem.
Aren't you saying
it's
that
not ending? It's no, the problem's not coming to an end.
But aren't there? I mean, certainly it's not simply alcoholics and folks who are hardcore, long-term, maybe even vet homeless folks who are spare changing. I'm not even sure if that's true. That it's primarily vets or even, you know, substantially vets who do that. But I mean, there are folks who are young folks who spare change downtown. There are deadheads who come through town and spare change. There are folks who don't look like alcoholics to me, for example, in front of the Cinema 9 with signs who spare change. There are, you know, street merchant jewelers who sell their wares and also spare change. I mean, it seems to me that there's a broader swath of people doing this than just that particular group. And this is not to take away from your suggestion that we should concern ourselves with that group, certainly.
Well, in order to end the problem, you must first help the ones that were there first. You just don't bury them in a landslide of services for the homeless, just for other homelesses from people from other towns to come and take advantage of the new services. Yet the same pockets are still out there, and they're not being helped at all. There's no trickle-down theory here. Most of the services that are being provided for us and everything are taken advantage by outsiders coming to the town to take advantage of the services. Yet friends of mine are still in these pockets out in the woods, and these are the same people that the community started complaining about to begin with. You know, let's put an end to this. And there are ways of ending it, and right now with the available facilities we have, there can be a lot of problems solved. It's just a matter of bringing up the services that, or how to provide services for these groups of people. There are ways, and I know of ways to help them.
That's, of course, what we're going to get into right next. And presumably, you these are folks you used to hang with, and perhaps still occasionally do stay in touch with, because you are a person who works at St. Francis Soup Kitchen. You were employed there, and I don't know, are you still employed there?
Yes, I still do security work there, watching the woods and stuff to make sure that the crack camps don't come back and the homeless camps don't just sprout up again. It wasn't even camps, it was more of a shanty town back there, but that problem's come to an end. But it's a revolving door type deal that, you know, if you let it go unattended, it'll just pop right back up.
Well, you and I probably disagree on the issue of looking at folks who are, you know, passing through or transient, and whether that, you know, you sound like you're being kind of critical of those folks. But I think what you're really saying, or maybe what you're not really saying, but part of what I hear you saying is, what about this group of folks who is out, you know, in camps, who need services, but somehow either they aren't getting them, and I think that's certainly true, or they don't want them in the way they're presented. What's the solution to this?
Okay, my solution is that because of the debate you had with Michael Rotkin, and he made the mistake of saying that just last year alone, Santa Cruz put up $1 million for the homeless.
Yeah! Sorry, man.
I thought, well, didn't they at least give a free meal? Why didn't anybody tell me? But the trickle-down theory didn't work on that $1 million somehow. I never felt any of it.
He means $1 million for the homeless bureaucrats. And again, actually, he said $9 million. And he, you know, I'm not even in a position to discuss the kinds of where he's what hat he's drawing his figures from. I know Celia Scott, our mayor, has taken severe exception to his figures and said they're not accurate. Certainly, Santa Cruz does provide some services. I'm glad we have a homeless community resource center that has, you know, options for a phone if you wait in line long enough, lockers if you, you know, if you're lucky, and I think actually many people can get lockers, a meal at 4 o'clock, and for a very few people, shelter at night. A very considerably smaller percent, I mean, an infinitesimal percentage compared to the number of people that are out there. You know, once the armory closes, I guess it's reopened for a week or so because of the bad weather, but it's going to be closed again. You've got, what, 500 to 1,500 homeless people and less than 40, space for 40 of them in the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program. Right. And even Rotkin agrees with that.
Okay. Now, the cure.
The cure.
The cure. Here is the cure. To begin with, I'd like to say that Karen Gillette, Mike Bustos, Sentinel Mike, I call him Sentinel Mike.
Carl Talk, yeah.
Oh, okay, I didn't know.
Or Sentinel Mike.
Sentinel Mike.
Guitar Mike as well. He's
right. The mall guitarist. Well, anyway, these people, they're inundated with people with problems and homeless problems and stuff. And their job, I mean, they couldn't possibly tackle the problem just them, that group of three. I mean, Karen's up to her neck with